Support for WGTD comes from Andrea's. Visit andreasgifts.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, books, and more. Now offering online ordering from Jack's Cafe, andreasgifts.com.
This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Mike Kehoe, a retired substitute teacher and a current special education support volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha, Chuck Wolbers, a special education teacher with Kenosha Unified Successful Transitions for Exceptional Students Program, and Steve Brown, assistant professor of educational leadership at UW-Oshkosh. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
And a very pleasant good morning and welcome to this edition of Education Matters here on WGTD HD, serving Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. And I'm your host this morning, Steve Brown. And my first guest in this segment is Heather Dubois-Bournon, and she is the Executive Director of the Wisconsin Public Education Network. Heather, welcome to Education Matters.
Well, thank you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
First of all, before we get into what the Wisconsin Public Education Network is all about, and just so our audience knows, several years ago I did interview Tom Beebe, who was the previous executive director. And, of course, as we move forward in our programming and also in education in the state, a lot of changes have taken place. So we'll get a real thumbnail sketch of what the WPEN is up to today in 2017. One of the first things, Heather, I always like to do with guests on Education Matters is to get a sense of who you are, where you grew up, where you went to school.
Sure. I'm actually a Michigan native. I grew up just outside of Grand Rapids, Michigan, in a little town called Lowell. And I attended Grand Rapids Christian Schools, K through 12. So I was shuttled from the little town I grew up in to the one town over, and attended that school partly on scholarship and partly on the hard work of my parents, who really struggled to send all five of their kids to that school. And while I got a great education there, I also saw a lot of inequities in that system and lack of access. I was always very envious of the community that my public school friends had with each other and with the town that we grew up in. So sending my own kids to public schools was always a no-brainer for me. And I now live in Sun Prairie with my husband and my two kids who attend Sun Prairie Public Schools, and we absolutely love it here.
You know, one of the things I think would be important for our listeners, if you could give an overview of what the Wisconsin Public Education Network is all about.
Well, we are an informal, grassroots, statewide coalition of people who care about our kids in our public schools. We try to bring together people who believe that every child in the state should have equal access and equal opportunity to succeed in their public school, whether those people are parents or community members or business leaders or school board members or administrators, people who work for DPI or for the state, or people who are members of professional education organizations, and take all of these people who have, you know, disparate groups and connections and areas of interest relating to education, and come together on the same page and say, okay, well, what do we have in common, and how can our voices be stronger together? One of the things that we've noticed, particularly over the past 10 years or so, is that public education advocates have been really great at speaking out and sharing their concerns. They've testified at hearings, they've written letters, they've stood up in their local communities, they've started to form grassroots groups. But what we didn't see in the past couple of budget cycles was that making a huge impact. And so one of the questions that we tried to ask is, why is it that we're speaking out but not being heard? when we look around at who did seem to be being heard, namely some lobbyists, people with political interests or monetary interests in this or that bill or legislation, we're just wondering, like, what does it take to get the ear? And so we've really worked hard to connect the dots across people and groups and give people a platform from which we have credible information, understanding of how the issues impact our schools, not just as kind of like a statewide problem, right? Our schools are struggling or funding is broken, but how does this impact local kids where you live? So we have this make it local philosophy, and we try to give people the tools to tell that story in a way that will have a more direct impact with decision makers. And we feel we're finally starting to see some changes, particularly in this budget cycle, that reflect that people are really being listened to now, and it's becoming increasingly difficult for lawmakers in particular to ignore the groundswell of support for public schools that's being heard across the state.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, Heather, about what's happening with the budget here in Wisconsin. And I'll just make it real simple. Why is the budget stalled with respect to public education, and what can be done to change that?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I know parents and community members all over the state are kind of looking at the Capitol right now, just thinking, what is going on? Throughout this entire budget process, we've heard basically one thing from both sides of the political fence, and that's that they heard us loud and clear. Education is the number one topic people are concerned about. It was the number one thing people testified about at all six of the public hearings on the budget. It has been, you know, the cornerstone of the governor's budget, and he's been going around from school to school promoting his education budget throughout the spring. So why are we stalled now? You know, was it two weeks ago, we have a Marquette poll coming out saying 80% of people want to see additional funding go into our public schools. Mm-hmm. People are overwhelmingly happy with their schools. So why are we stalled out? Every day that the legislature doesn't pass a budget is another day that districts are operating in the dark on next year's plans. They have to do their hiring. They have to, you know, set their budgets for the year. Many districts have already had to pass these, blind of how much state aid they're going to receive. So given the crisis of state funding and the uncertainties around federal funding this year as well, it's really dangerous time to be playing political games with the future of our kids in schools. So parents were very upset when they heard that the assembly was kind of dragging its heels and had issues with the governor's proposal to invest $200 per pupil in the next biennium in the first year and then $204 the second year. And the proposal that they offered as kind of a counterplan did include some welcome changes, increasing the revenue caps for some of the districts that need that the most. That would be wonderful. But nobody was particularly fooled by the idea that that suggestion was the equivalent of giving schools the funding they need, right? Saying you can spend more is not the same as giving you more money to spend.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what parents are hoping to see is some kind of compromise that will include the best of both proposals rather than taking more money away from kids. People are also extremely concerned about rumors that there have been closed-door negotiations to increase the eligibility limits for students participating in the statewide voucher program. That would have a very negative fiscal impact on our public schools, and that's something that has had no opportunity to be vetted by the public yet, wasn't part of the original budget proposal, and certainly wasn't something that I heard anyone ask for at any of the public hearings on the budget. So people are very cautiously optimistic that legislators will hold true on their promise to reinvest in our schools this year, but also very wary. We've seen last-minute budget shenanigans in the past couple of cycles that have had really catastrophic effects on local districts, and that is something we really don't want to see again this time around. So I'd encourage everyone who's listening to just take time to shoot an email to your elected officials and members of that Joint Finance Committee and ask them, you know, are you standing firm in your commitment to public schools, and how will I know you're going to vote accordingly?
Sure, and on your website, there's actually a listing of all the members of that committee with their email addresses. Since you brought up at the federal level, and we talked very briefly at the beginning of your background, having grown up in Western Michigan, let's talk very briefly about our new Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, who, of course, historically has a very strong interest in vouchers and in charter schools and non-public charter schools, but very specifically in vouchers. What is your number one biggest concern about Betsy DeVos as our U.S. Secretary of Education?
It's a question of allegiance. I have seen no evidence that Ms. DeVos cares about public school students. Her entire career, really, as an education influencer, she's never actually worked in this field, has been in promoting privatization and pulling more funds away from public schools and into private hands, whether it's through vouchers that give public tax dollar funded tuition to students who attend private schools, or through independently operated charter schools, which we sometimes call public in name only. Now, whether the question of her allegiance can be proven, I don't know, but her history does speak for itself, and she simply has no experience in the public sector. And so I think what makes everyone on our end just very nervous is, what are her motives? You know, why would someone who with such a long history of being adversarial to public education be appointed to the most important job in the country? You know, we want to see somebody in that role who loves our public schools, who believes in their potential, and who believes in the students who attend them, not someone who is willing to publicly make remarks about how the system needs to be dismantled. It's just a dangerous position for her to hold, and I'm wary of what kind of policy may come out of it, or what kind of decisions may be made given her inexperience in this area.
When you hear and see members of the governor's own party being very supportive of public education, and when I go around the state, and maybe when you do and others, and hear all the negative things about Act 10 and all the bad things, when you hear things like that, what kind of reaction do you have as a parent, as someone who's involved in public education?
Well, I guess I'll start for me personally. It's just a huge relief. I was devastated by some of the remarks we were hearing from lawmakers in and around 2011, disparaging our public school system, disparaging our educators, and just kind of generally painting a really negative picture of our amazing public schools that felt like really inaccurate to me and out of step with lived reality for most Wisconsinites. And so I feel like it's just refreshing to have kind of seen in a relatively short period of time a change in the discourse and moving back toward, you know, a more positive and aspirational message from Republicans and Democrats alike about what we need to do to invest in the future of our kids. So from that point of view, it's heartening. You know, I do travel around the state and talk to people about what's going on in their local schools, what challenges they're facing, what their hopes are for kids. And I would say the thing that I hear the most frequently from parents especially, is that people are just sick and tired of the political games. They don't like that education has become kind of the political football being tossed around. They don't understand it. It doesn't make sense. Whether they're Democrats or Republicans themselves, it's, you know, when did education become a negotiable? investing in our kids should be a non-negotiable. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't even have to say that out loud. It's sad that we've come to a point where someone does need to say it.
Yeah, you know, and I agree 100%. And I've been an educator for over 30 years. And when I sat down and had the conversation with Senator Olson, and after we finished taping, I just said to him, you know, as you know, Luther served on his school board for over 20 years. He's a strong supporter of public education. Robin Voss is a product of public education all through his career in education, if you will, you know, K through 12 and in higher ed. And you're right. You know, we have outstanding schools. We have always had outstanding schools in this state. We still do. That doesn't mean there aren't problems. We've always had problems. School districts, any school might have a problem, but we have extraordinary teachers. We have extraordinary parents who are involved in their community and wonderful school board members. I wanted to wrap things up by maybe having you talk a bit about the summer summit coming up on August 9th. I know that that's going to be at Lake Mills High School. And maybe if you could talk a bit about what this is all about.
So once a year, we do physically come together through what we call a summer summit. And at that event, we invite anyone who wants to learn more about the challenges and opportunities facing our schools and or how to just become a better local level advocate or a state influencer to join us. This year's summit is going to be in Lake Mills at Lake Mills High School. We're being hosted by the CAPE team there, and we're expecting anywhere from 400 to 500 people to come together and talk about things like school funding, how to raise your voice locally, the teacher shortage crisis that's facing the state, issues of diversity and equity, how to support your schools without being perceived as a cheerleader for the status quo, which none of us in our network certainly are, right? Our schools, as you said, do have serious challenges that we want to work to overcome, and sometimes we're so distracted by these other issues that it's hard for us to advocate for everything.
Mm-hmm.
So we create one day where we kind of take all of the issues that people have voice to us are the most important of the year. We invite experts and advocates from around the state to lead sessions on those, and we bring everybody together. So you can get tickets on our website, wisconsinnetwork.org, and we invite everyone who's listening to check it out and join us there.
Well, I want to thank you, Heather, for taking your time, And hopefully I can have you as a guest once again on Education Matters, maybe sometime in the fall, and we can talk about what some of the ongoing projects are for the Wisconsin Public Education Network.
Yeah, I'd love to talk anytime.
Okay, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
And before we continue with the next segment of Education Matters here on WGTD-HD, I did want to remind you that I am your host this week, Steve Brown. One of the items that we did talk about was the budget and how it pertains to public education. In an article that appeared on the public site of the Wisconsin Public Education Network, it's entitled Public School Advocates Funding for Wisconsin's Public Schools is Still Tight. It's dated July the 6th of 2017, and it does reference an article by Alan Borsuk, who writes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and in his June 30th column in that newspaper, entitled Three Signs Supporting Public Schools is in Vogue for Politicians, it says, yes, Governor Walker proposed a $200 per pupil increase for the 2017-18 school year, with an additional $204 for the following school year. And yes, reports coming out of Madison seem to indicate that the state legislature is likely to approve those levels. We are hoping for the best, but continue to hold our collective breath until the state budget is actually signed. Borsuk wrote, and these are his words, school advocates have done an effective job of educating politicians about their situations. and we proudly count ourselves. This is according to the Wisconsin Public Education Network. And we proudly count ourselves among the hundreds of grassroots advocates and fellow parents and grandparents statewide who have spoken up over the past 6 months. In addition to teachers and superintendents who have been advocating for their schools, volunteers have spent hundreds of hours calling, emailing, and visiting our legislators. We've testified at Joint Finance Committee hearings, and we've sent thousands of postcards to the Capitol. Nonetheless, even if the proposed levels of funding are approved, Borsuk acknowledges, and we, meaning the Wisconsin Public Education Network, wholeheartedly agree that school budgets remain tight and $200 is only a big deal compared to the last 6 years. And those are the words from the Wisconsin Public Education Network. And again, I do wish to thank Heather Dubois-Bournon for being my guest on the first segment of Education Matters here on WGTD HD. And we continue now with segment two of Education Matters here on WGTD HD. I'm very pleased to welcome Christina Samuels, Assistant Editor for Education Week, and welcome to Education Matters.
Thank you.
I always like to start with guests in terms of getting some of your own background, where you went to school, where you grew up, where you went to college, so at least our listeners have some background of who you are.
Sure. Well, I grew up in suburban Washington, D.C. in Virginia, and I attended college at Florida A&M University, where I majored in journalism. I worked at the Miami Herald. I then moved to the Washington Post, where I first started covering education. And in 2004, I moved to Education Week, where I've been covering special education and a variety of other beats, but right now special education and early childhood education.
One of the articles that you wrote recently, it appeared online on April 19th of this year, and then it was in print in the April 20th edition of Education Week. And it really caught my eye, and the headline is that the number of U.S. students in special education is moving upward. And I thought maybe if we could talk about that, and maybe if you could just give us some background about that.
Yeah, this was a really interesting piece to do. For the last, I would say, since about 2004, which was when the last time was the special education law was reauthorized by Congress, it's called the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, and it oversees, it sort of spells out all the rules the schools and districts must follow with special education. Well, since that time, there had been a pretty steady decrease in the number of students with disabilities, and there's a lot of reasons why that could be happening. There were some things written into the law that encouraged schools to use different sort of educational methods and techniques before evaluating a child with special education services. There were some other things going on in the what was then known as the No Child Left Behind Act that sort of encouraged schools and districts to perhaps keep the numbers of their special education students low. And so, you know, one would hope that perhaps these students were getting what they needed, but just outside the specific special education system. So since 2004, there had been this downswing, but then in the last couple of years, maybe 3 years or so, there has been an uptick again. And what has been interesting is that that number has been driven pretty much by an increase in the number of students with autism and an increase in the number of students who are classified as having other health impairments. Mm-hmm. Now, this is not something that, unfortunately, the Department of Education doesn't go into further detail about what other health impairments are, but often this includes children who have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. It could also include children who have mental health disorders such as bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, anxiety, depression, and then it would also include children who might have diabetes, epilepsy, other types of health, mobility impairments, other type of health impairments, that they are all sort of lumped into this group. I would suspect that a large proportion of students in this category have ADHD.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, Christina, based on what you said, and I'm looking at the chart right now, and I see the increase from 2005 to 2014, the increase in autism, autistic students who are categorized for special ed is up, as you indicated, 165%. But one of the things you mentioned, and you talk about it in your article, do you think there's been a concerted effort to downtick, if you will, I'm making up this word now, to downtick the number of students in special ed, even though they get additional funding and there are other things that school districts get through IDEA and later through No Child Left Behind?
Yeah, you know, that's a challenging question. And the reason I say this without trying to escape it is that there are so many school districts and so many things that go into play with what an individual school or district or state may be doing, which is a challenge in itself, right? Because, I mean, we can see that the rates of students with autism, for example, really varies a lot from state to state. Now, is it that New Jersey just happens to have more students with autism than a state like Arkansas, for example? Or are there other policy things at play that make it more possible for you to be diagnosed as having autism in New Jersey versus Arkansas? I tend to think it's the latter. I tend to think that there's a lot of policy elements that go into whether a child is diagnosed with a disability or not, or what disability category that child is placed in.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be a concern. You know, one thing that was interesting to me in reporting the story that you're referring to is when I was talking with people at the Department of Education, they said that the federal government requires that a school district diagnose a child with a disability or if he or she has one. So they're not supposed to be able to duck this, although, you know, sometimes things happen. But they are not guaranteed a certain type of category. If you have autism, and for whatever reason, or if you have some symptoms of autism, but a district says, you know, this looks like emotional disturbance to us, then you don't have a right to say, actually, it looks more like autism to me. I mean, you have a right in the sense that a parent can go to due process and can, you know, challenge a certain diagnosis. So, but you can't just say like, nah, I just want to be in another category.
Mm-hmm.
So all this to say that I do think that there's a lot of policy elements at play. In some places, it could serve to perhaps depress the number of students with disabilities because even though you're getting money from the federal government and from the state, it doesn't necessarily cover the full cost. There could be other places where, for whatever reason, there are some incentives to over-identify students with disabilities because of the funding, those different funding formulas at those states and those districts. So there are, you know, I have jokingly said to my boss before, I wish we did not have all 50 states and that all 50 of these states had so many school districts within them because it's hard sometimes to get a feel for what is happening at the local level. There's definitely a lot that goes into play there, and I definitely would say that there are policy elements to all of this.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you pointed out, you mentioned New Jersey, but in your article, and you were just using that as an example, I know, but in your article you talk very specifically about the state of Virginia, which is not mm-hmm. too far from where you are right now in Maryland, that it's among the states that has seen a large increase in population. And you quote some comments made by John Eisenberg, who's the state director of special ed. And here's a state that in the past, at least, had a low incidence of autism, and now they've had this huge increase. Did you get any sense at all as to why? I mean, I know everyone likes to report numbers, but are there any reasons why, other than that they're being classified a little differently, or there's a more concerted effort to identify them?
One thing that I could say that was happening in Virginia and probably is happening in a lot of other states is that while there has been this large increase in the number of students with autism, there has also been a decrease in the number of students with disabilities that may look like autism, which would be learning disabilities is a category under IDEA that's been going down. Emotional disabilities has also been going down, and intellectual disabilities are three disabilities that all have been on the downswing while autism has been on the upswing. Also, I think that research has shown that there is just actually an organic number increase in the number of kids diagnosed with autism. So there's some things going on that they call reclassification. So students who might have been put in one category being put into another, and then also perhaps students who might not have been diagnosed with any disability before. Maybe they might have been called quirky or, you know, whatever kind of, you know, sort of non-medical judgment that somebody might have made, that people are looking at this now and saying, no, this actually may be on the a form of autism. Autism is, you know, known as a spectrum disorder. So there's a lot of different ways that it manifests itself. When I was reporting that particular story, somebody suggested, and we were just sort of hypothesizing as we were talking, is that perhaps these milder forms of autism are being caught more now because people just have more of an awareness of what autism looks like and the features of autism. And so certain things that weren't that might have been getting ignored or sort of glossed over in prior years may just be getting more attention now. And so that could also be driving this increase that we're seeing in that particular category. Mm-hmm.
I was really fascinated by the article that you wrote May 31st, was published on June 1st, headline, "Are There Too Few Minority Students in Special Education?" I really found your article here, and you quoted some of the research of Paul Morgan and George Farkas. Maybe if you could talk a bit about this, because I think this is something that we don't hear enough about, and maybe we need to.
Yeah, this was a fascinating story to do, and I've covered this a few times in a few different stories, but this was a larger piece that I was able to kind of pull some threads together here. So since IDEA came into law in the mid-70s, there's always been a concern that minority students, and here really I'm speaking about black students, that black students and Hispanic students in some cases have been overrepresented in special education, particularly in the disabilities that are believed to carry the most stigma. So we're talking about what was then known as mental retardation, now we call it intellectual disability, and emotional disturbances. And there's been a long-running concern, and that has been backed up by research that shows that black students are represented in those categories at rates greater than their representation in the population as a whole. So, you know, if you have, you know, black students with mental retardation, there's a higher percentage of them in that category than there are just in the student body as a whole. So that's been a long-running concern, and IDEA is kind of built around trying to stop that from happening. There are elements that have been written into the law in the past couple of years that have told states and school districts, look, you need to be careful not to over-identify black students and Hispanic students and minority students as being in any category. You need to keep an eye out for this. Well, Paul Morgan and George Farkas looked at this data, and they used a data set of young students, and they tracked them over time. And they said that when you equalize students as much as possible, so you say you take a black student and a white student, and when you control for things such as poverty, such as academic performance, such as family makeup, and other kinds of things, and so you make them as similar as possible, you actually see that black students are less likely to be identified for being in special education And this is true even in those categories, those what are considered to be stigmatizing categories. So as you can imagine, this is not just like kind of a tweak of what has been accepted wisdom. This is just going against completely what has been accepted wisdom for quite some time in the field. And ever since, and they've actually come up with several studies that have said this. They've looked at different ways of analyzing the data and different disability categories. But what got the most attention was when they wrote a piece in the New York Times not too long ago that said that if there is racism in special education, it is actually that black students are not getting it as much as they need to. And as you can imagine, that has caused quite a lot of attention within the advocacy community. There's a lot of people who think that they are just outright wrong. There's a lot of people who say, well, you know, maybe they're not wrong here, but they're overstating the case. And they've come back and had some responses to the responses and it goes on. But it's a very interesting situation, and their argument is that maybe districts are feeling constrained from providing services to children because they fear being called racist if they place a child in special education. And their argument is that if special education is a civil right and if you are supposed to get it if you meet these certain standards, that not providing it to a child is as racist as giving it to a child who doesn't need it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely been a lot of really interesting conversation about that.
Yeah, in fact, the editorial that they wrote that appeared in the New York Times, I know that got a lot of attention, and I read the actual research paper, and one of the things that you point out is that both Morgan and Farkas, they have replicated this study a number of times and essentially get the same kinds of results. So why do they think that there's so much pushback? I know the article that was in the New York Times, that there's even a reference to the fact that there are some people in policymaking decisions who do believe that in particular African-American students are overrepresented in special education.
Yeah, I think that, they would, characterize the pushback as coming from people who have done other types of research that have come up with opposite findings. And their response to that is that that research was not as statistically rigorous as the research that they have done. And so that's their – and, of course, nobody wants to say, like, well, your research was shoddy and that's why you came up with the wrong result. So there's definitely going to be some arguments there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, what this really comes down to is I think that it touches on some very sticky subjects and very – passionate subjects that people feel about race and how students are treated in school because of their race. You can walk into a classroom and see a lot of black students in certain self-contained classrooms and in classrooms where for students with severe disabilities, and it just doesn't feel right. It could, your feeling may be like, why are all these black students here? And what they're saying is those black students are there is because they are actually manifesting certain qualities that go along with being diagnosed with certain disabilities. That's why you see so many, but that if you kind of statistically control for the things that I mentioned earlier, they're actually underrepresented. So what they could be saying is that as many as you think you're seeing, you really should be seeing more.
Mm-hmm.
That worries people. I think that it also speaks a lot to what we think about special education, to be honest. Special education should not be considered something that is good or bad. It's value neutral. It's a set of services that come with being diagnosed with a certain set of disabilities. Nevertheless, it's considered in many places to be a lesser education. You're less likely to graduate. You're less likely to have opportunities to do certain, be involved in certain activities of the school. You're more likely to drop out. There's a lot of sort of negative consequences, unfortunately, that go with being enrolled in special education. And so if someone were to say, well, actually, we think that more black kids deserve to be here, that is going to feel not good to a lot of observers who would question the value of special education. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a big underlying piece of this debate as well. It is definitely an interesting story. And I will say, you know, just to add something to the people who have said that this is doesn't match with their own research, is that this comes from big national data sets. And much as I was saying that special education plays out differently from place to place, some people have said, well, sure, you know, this plays out differently in different areas. There are some states, some school districts, some areas, some parts of the country where overrepresentation may be more of a problem than in other parts of the country. That data that Morgan and Farkas looked at, I don't believe gets into geographic distinctions mm-hmm. like that.
Somewhat related to what you were just saying, the whole aspect of special education, and maybe if we can maybe shift to the fact that that there's a need for more special education teachers. And in an article that you wrote back at the end of January of this year, you talked about that. And one of the quotes from Mary Brownell, who is a professor at my former alma mater, the University of Florida, said that one of the reasons why, at least with her research, that shows that there are teachers who go into teacher education who choose not to go into special ed is because oftentimes they have to teach more subjects. But as you look at the big picture and you look at the fact that there's a real need for more special education teachers, in putting together that article, what did you come away with as far as what you see teacher education across the country trying to do to attract more future teachers into special ed?
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things that I learned about was universities that are trying to work with students, even in high school, to get them interested in working with their peers with disabilities, with the thinking that if they go into teaching, then they will be more interested in continuing to work with other with young people with disabilities. I think that there's a lot of people who go into special education because they had that background, that specific experience that really just sort of charged them up and just said, like, yeah, you know, this is something that I think I can do, and this is something that I want to do. I thought that was really fascinating, is the idea that you could start even before even before young people become teachers, even if they're just thinking about it, and get them involved in some of these peer counseling type of activities mm-hmm. and get them interested in that. But I think that one of the things that, you know, people have to think about is universities prepare teachers, of course. And then once that teacher is placed in a school, that is really what I believe makes a big difference about who's going to stay in special education and who is going to just see it as something overwhelming or something that they don't want to continue. I think that school experience and how that teacher is integrated into the life of the school, how that teacher partners with other teachers, because special education teachers are very often asked to work in partnership with general education teachers, and sometimes general education teachers aren't wanting to do that so much. A lot of these things play a big role in how successful a special education teacher is going to be once they leave college.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank you for taking your time, Christina, to talk about special education, because certainly that's a very important area. My last question for you is, what are you working on right now, and what might we expect in an upcoming article in Education Week? And for our listeners, if you're interested in following what's happening in education, in particular what Christina Samuels writes, you can go to edweek.org, and you can at least see some of the articles on there. But what are you working on right now?
Yeah, Yeah, well, I'm working on an interesting story about what happens if you accept a voucher or some other kind of school choice mechanism. Education savings accounts are very popular right now. What happens to your IDEA rights if you place your child in a private school with a state-funded voucher? And, you know, I'm finding that there's been some studies that have looked at this recently, and I found some parents to talk about what their experience has been. And it's interesting. It's a challenging situation for parents often to say that they're going to leave the public school system and go the private route. But a lot of parents choose to do this because they feel that ultimately that's making a better choice for them and their families. And I think that there's a lot of vouchers out there that actually are aimed directly at parents of students with disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm exploring that for a story that hopefully will become